All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Steve Miller is on the show today. Yep, that's Steve Miller, okay? Steve Miller. Fly like an eagle, Steve Miller. The Joker, Steve Miller. Come on. Big old jet airliner, Steve Miller. It just came up. He's releasing a previously unreleased live concert. It was a concert on the actual Fly Like an Eagle tour, and the full concert will also be on Amazon Prime. It's a weird bit of nostalgia because it's shot on old equipment, and as Steve will tell you, he's got all this stuff in his warehouse, and he wasn't going to release it necessarily, but he found some like massive master recording of the same show, perfect kind of soundboard, 32-track, 16-track, whatever the hell it is, recording of the thing, and he synced it up. And it's definitely a time capsule. And I think we all forget just how fucking huge Steve Miller was. So I'm like, of course I'll talk to Steve Miller, because he was around, man. Interesting story. He was around. He goes way back. And it was exciting, actually. And I'm glad we spoke. So that's happening soon. Another thing I want to promote, if I can, is that me and my buddy Dean Del Rey have joined forces, and we've created this podcast called Dark Fonzie. And I will explain, if you listen to it, we explain the name. But it's basically a very relevant podcast. It's two middle-aged straight white dudes with no children talking. Come on. This is cutting-edge stuff. Let me say it again. Two middle-aged white dudes with no children, straight white dudes, talking. So, I mean, you don't want to miss out on that. I'm underselling it. Dean is a dear friend, and it was just something we came up with months ago when we were touring. And we were doing live Instagram lives, and it sort of evolved. The Dark Fonzie name came out of one of those in the car. And we have these car conversations. I mean, Dean is much more of a focused nerd than I am when it comes to, you know, like pants, boots, watches, cars, mid-century houses, eyeglasses. He's all in with all of it. But I find him entertaining, and we're close, and he opens for me a lot on the road. So, and he's very easy to travel with because we're buddies, and we like to eat the same things. And, you know, I always learn some stuff from Dean about things that I don't think I need, and then I buy them. So that's Dark Fonzie. I guess you can get it certainly on iTunes and where you get podcasts. Episode 1 is out there, and I think it was good. I just let him deal with it. He came over here. We talked. I said, all right, knock yourself out. So I got to tell you, man, I did comedy the other night for the first time in over a year on Friday night. I did my first spot in the original room at the Comedy Store. I had not been to the Comedy Store in over a year. I did not do any other shows over a year. No, a year without stand-up. No Zoom shows, no outdoor shows. I refused to do that to myself. I felt I'd worked too hard. And even though it was adaptive, I didn't feel the need to do that. I didn't feel the need to struggle. I didn't feel the need to entertain in a parking lot or with masks or, you know, Zooming. I didn't need it. I didn't want to, because I knew it would be stressful and it would not be good. The Comedy Store is a comedy club. It's the comedy club. It's so itself. I mean, just driving over there was a nice day. I got a little dressed up, put on a nice jacket that I haven't worn in a long ever, maybe the first night. And I didn't really know what I was going to do. But for the week leading up to it, after I decided that maybe I would not need to do comedy anymore, all of a sudden, the idea that the store was open, I was sort of like, go out there, man. It wasn't that I was excited, or maybe I'm not admitting I was excited. I can't tell you really, but I was definitely not afraid. And, you know, I did the Tonight Show last week, so I had some stuff in my head that I worked through with the segment producer over there. And I'm like, all right, that's shaped up. I mean, if worst comes to worst, I can just run that stuff or whatever. Just go. So, man, I got to the store and it was it was moving. First of all, they built an entire fucking hotel and apartment complex across the street in a year. Like, I got there and there's a whole new building right across the street. Somebody didn't take any time off. It's this huge, they were building it. They were kind of building it a year ago, but now it's all built. But the Comedy Store remains the same. It remains the same. The pictures in the hallways remain the same. The walls, the writing on the building, the neon. There's a new neon for Jeff, the piano player for years who passed away during COVID. They were checking people, comics, at the back door to see if they were vaxxed. And if they weren't, they would give them a quick test. Audience members needed to show proof of vax or that they were tested negative. And it was just wild. I mean, obviously, it was quiet. It was different. I guess it's like 30% capacity. I don't even know how many people were there, but they were small spaced out crowds in both the main room and the OR. And when I got there, I realized like, oh, this doesn't fucking matter. We're all trying to get, we're all doing something new. Audiences are new. They're coming and they it's been a year for them too. And they know we've all been in the same place. We all took a year off to be terrified and wonder if the world was ending or whether or not we would die and try to maintain our sanity. I just didn't know what would happen. But the great thing was I waited for the comedy club because, look, man, all of us comics have done shows for 2 people, 3 people, 9 people, 12 people. Look, the difference between 20 people in a comedy club spread out and a fucking parking lot is massive. The context holds. The place is grounded and reliable. As the fucking, you know, Mount Sinai, for fuck's sake. It's the Godhead. It's Mecca. It stays. It remains the same. And just walking those halls, I saw Neil Brennan, and he's like, how you doing? I'm like, I don't know, man. I haven't seen these guys in a year. And I'm like, it almost felt like crying. It almost felt like Neil would have been the right guy to cry to. He could have handled it. But we were both like, I don't know. And it was just that same thing. You know, I was happy with doing nothing or not. I mean, obviously, I've been working the whole time, but I was happy with the idea that maybe I didn't need to do stand-up anymore. And the only benefit of the lockdown was that no one was doing it. And I think once I started to see people scheduling shit, that part of me that is driven by spite and just that competitive nature of staying in the fucking game woke up. Didn't take much. It was lightly sleeping, but right away I was like, fuck, he's going out. I got to figure out what I got. I got to get on this. But it was so great, man. I saw Esther Pavitsky, Steve Renazzisi, who else was around? Neil was there. But that first set was just great. It was very comfortable. I mean, like I said, there's not big crowds there, but we're all fucking excited in some way to see what happens because it's been so long. And I kind of got through some stuff. I found some new stuff. I might have found some themes to start working on to build an hour with. And I just left feeling like, all right, that guy's awake. The guy that lives on stage is awake. He's ready to go. And the fucking notebook comes out. I'm putting things together in my head. I've got pieces of paper all over the place. It took a day, a fucking day. And then went back Saturday night, saw Jeselnik. We had some laughs in back, and Kevin Nealon, Spade was there, and Esther again, and Maz Jobrani, Luke Schwartz, who opens for me sometimes, working the door. And I just riffing, man, getting on it. Some dark stuff, some stuff evolving already, but it was just to feel the chops come back. I've been doing this more than half my fucking life. What was I thinking? I don't think in the last week, I didn't think, like for a while there, I was like, I don't know if I can do it anymore. But the last week leading up to this, I'm like, of course I can do it. Why am I, what? There's no reason to freak yourself out, bro. So I call myself bro sometimes. I mean, you live and sleep and eat this shit, man. It's not even like riding a bike. It's just who you are, stupid. It's who you are. It's nice. It was nice. It was fun. And I'm ready. Tickets are on sale for my Dynasty Typewriter shows here in Los Angeles for July. I'll be doing a month of Thursdays there. Hopefully by that time I'll have some through lines and we can riff out some stuff. Maybe help me build that hour. I'm going to regret not hitting the road sooner. I just feel it. Whatever. It doesn't matter, man. I woke up the comic and he was barely asleep. Folks, Steve Miller, Breaking Ground, the concert album from August 3rd, 1977, comes out this Friday, May 14th. And the accompanying live concert film featuring the full performance will be available to stream on the Coda Collection on Amazon Prime Video. Steve Miller's songs are wired into certainly people my age's brains. Junior high, baby. Junior high. Fly like an eagle to the sea. Come on. Time keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the future. Come on. Time to appreciate or reappreciate Steve Miller. This is me talking to Steve Miller right now. How are you, Steve Miller?
Hey, I'm really good, Mark. How are you today?
I'm good, man. Where you? You got a little office going there? Is that your house?
Yeah, I'm in my house. I'm in my attic. This is where this is my room where I do my artwork. So I'm
That's great.
Up here, this is where I hang out.
And you got a nice cigar going indoors. It's nice to see someone smoking a cigar indoors.
Yeah, well, that's the way I live my life, Mark. You know, it's like, that's why I work so hard, so I can smoke cigars where I fucking want to.
What kind are you smoking? I gave them up.
I don't know. It's a nice, strong cigar. A mystery cigar out of the box.
Sure.
I take the labels off, so I don't know.
You know, it's weird, man. I watched the release of the 1977 concert. I watched it last night, and it was kind of a journey back because... I don't know who shot that thing or what they shot it on, but...
I don't know either. I haven't got a clue.
Well, where'd you find this? What's the story behind pulling this thing out of the vault?
Well, I have a vault.
I know. I believe you.
It's a big warehouse that I built years ago. And, you know, like most people, you know, like I did stuff and I'd throw things in there and figured later I'd go through it all. Of course, I never wanted to go through any of it. And I had a really good pal of mine go through and listen to stuff and look at things. And he spent a year and a half doing it. There was 30 years of stuff. We did this, started this 15 years ago or something.
Wow.
Anyway, he found this concert and the copy I had was on some kind of cassette and it looked horrible. It was all purple and pink. And the sound, it sounded like the guitars were coming through a telephone or something. And I just looked at it and said, man, you know, we can't use that. Get out of here. You know, next.
Yeah.
And I actually rejected anything and everything found in the vault. And then my wife, Janice, who's the archivist, she went back and found it and she brought it to me and she showed it to me. And I said, honey, you know, this really, it sounds so bad. I can't release that. I'm not going to release that. And she said, well, we found out that you have you made a multi-track recording of it. So it turns out I did a 24-track recording that night that I didn't really know. We finally got, you know, everything indexed where we started going through tape. So I said, okay, well, let's mix that and see what it sounds like. And God, it was just what I feel is just a great performance of that band. So then I had to like figure out how to try to make this really terrible video, you know, watchable, you know?
Yeah.
So we, you know, we hired some guy in Scotland and he started like schmoozing it and somebody else started schmoozing a little bit and it finally got to the point where you could kind of see what it was. And then,
I like the camera effects, you know, the single switch camera effects.
Yeah. Well, you know, so the thing that got me was when Janice finally said to me, she said, sweetheart, it's just a really nice look back at the goofy 70s. It's the 70s,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I went, well, yeah, I guess it is. But, I mean, you know, we had this unbelievable laser show going on and it looks like, you know, like big blanks of white stuff going across. Yeah. and people are smoking in the audience and stuff like that. You know, it's like pretty funny show.
Well, it's the effects are very dated, but it does look like an artifact of that time. I mean, you can tell it was shot on that time. And then you did a couple of like sort of sarcastic disclaimers at the beginning that you must have just put on there.
Yeah, right. Well, the whole thing sort of looks to me like a late night sex messaging ad from the 80s. Or
sure.
Something. It's got that bright yellow color and all that stuff. So we had, you know, we just put it together. And at the end of the day, what I really enjoyed about it was it captured that band. You know, it was a really exciting time. And this was a time when we didn't, like, nobody was videotaping us. We weren't on television. I mean, there was nothing going on. And so to find something where you could just actually see what that band was like. And I just liked the energy of it. I thought we were just unconscious. Nobody was thinking or stinking.
No, it was great, man. And I mean, what that was, you were touring Fly Like an Eagle?
Yeah, that was the Fly Like an Eagle tour.
You know, because I was like, you know, look, man, I'm 57. So I grew up, I was in like, I guess, junior high, probably, you know, or maybe the first year of high school when that album came out. It was a huge record. There just seemed to be, you know, You Dominated and Heart and Bob Seger. You know, there was just these bands that are forever part of my brain. But like what I didn't really realize until just last night watching that concert. So Norton Buffalo on the other harmonica?
Yeah.
So it's you two. You come out there with those harps, and I hear the rhythm harp, and then all of a sudden I hear you blasting through with your chops, and I was like, holy fuck! You know, this is who that guy is. This is what he wanted to be. He's a blues guy. Like, I mean.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, I love blues, and I played a long time in Chicago, and I grew up in Texas.
Well,
and,
but like you can like those harp licks, you know, you sound like Blind Al Wilson or Little Walter, you know, Butterfield. I mean, you got the licks. I mean, you obviously put the work in.
Well, I've been playing harmonica from Texas since I was like 14 years old.
So where did you come from originally?
Well, I was born in Milwaukee, but I moved to Texas when I was five. So I grew up in Dallas, and Dallas was completely segregated. Was a really strange world for a young kid to walk into.
Yeah.
But there were black radio stations, there were black blues programs, there were R&B shows, there were all this black culture. There was Mexican culture, there was country music, there's all that stuff. So I just grew up loving blues. I grew up in a house where a lot of blues and gospel music was played. And
why is that? Your folks are musicians?
Yeah, my mother's side of the family were all musicians, and they were Scottish, and they played violin. They played hot jazz violin and guitar and banjo and stuff like that. And when the Depression came, they all stopped playing and went to medical school and became doctors.
Huh.
And my uncle Dale gave me my first guitar when I was five.
Yeah.
And Les Paul was my godfather. He taught chords on the, guitar.
How the hell was Les Paul your godfather? That wasn't in Texas. He was in New Jersey, wasn't he?
He was in Milwaukee.
He was in Milwaukee.
Yeah, you want me to tell you the story? It goes like this. So we are living in Milwaukee.
Yeah,
it's
Milwaukee.
It's like the late 40s. It's right after World War II.
It's still a poppin' city then.
Yeah. Milwaukee was a place where what happened was people would come and play there after they played in Chicago.
Right, right. You know,
they'd
okay,
play
sure,
Chicago and then
sure.
They'd jump over to Milwaukee, 90 miles away, and play a gig there.
Got it.
Les Paul was from Wisconsin. He was getting ready to do a radio show in New York with Mary Ford, and he wanted to rehearse.
Uh-huh.
So he brought Mary Ford and his trio, and they came to Milwaukee and stayed there for 6 weeks and played a dinner club called Jimmy Fazio's Supper Club. And
that sounds like an on-the-level business.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the mob in Milwaukee was not nice, you know, but it was like second rate to the Chicago mob, which was the big mob. Yeah,
it was a satellite mob.
Jimmy Fazio was a great guy. He ran a nice supper club. And,
sure.
And my father was a pathologist. He was a doctor.
Yeah.
But he loved music. My mother sang like Ella Fitzgerald and was incredible. And he had a wire recorder, you know, a wire recorder. And he would record everything with that. And
what's a wire recorder?
A wire recorder is what was before a tape recorder. And it was like a spool of copper wire. It was like a fishing reel. And it was horrible because it was constantly coming off the reel. It was just a complete mess. And it's how we recorded. Well, after World War II, the Germans developed tape recording technology. Mm. We got it. And a company named Magnacorder in like 1949 started making tape recorder.
Sure.
My old man got one. And the tape recorder, this was like the professional tape recorder, the best tape recorder there was.
Right. You know?
And Les Paul shows up about 3 minutes from where we live playing in this funky club. My dad goes over to see him and says, "Hey, I have a tape recorder. Can I come over and record you?" And Les said, "Yeah." So every night, my dad would go over and record Les Paul.
And he's a techie. Now, Les Paul's like an early innovator techie guy.
Yeah, Les Paul invented the multi-track tape recording system. So this was right down his alley.
Right.
So for him to meet, but more than being just a techie, he was a genius. He invented a lot of great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But my old man was right in his league. And so he had a shop down in the basement of this little funky townhouse we lived in, and he was working with plexiglass, and he was building television sets. And this is 1949, so Les Paul comes over. They became instant best buddies. They're making guitar picks. They're making clear plexiglass pick guards. Pop's playing him the tapes of the show, and he's taking me every night to see Les Paul. So now I got Les Paul and Mary Ford hanging out in my house, and I'm 4.5 years old. And my Uncle Dale just gave me a guitar, his guitar. I've got this little Gibson guitar.
Yeah.
And Les and Mary got married in Milwaukee. My mom and dad were the best man and woman at their wedding.
Wow.
And Les became my godfather. And I was in love with Mary Ford. I thought she was the most beautiful thing in the world. But the real important part of this story was I realized that Les Paul was like speeding the tape up.
Uh-huh.
And slowing it down. And I knew that Mary Ford was singing harmony with herself.
Yeah.
They went on to New York, had their radio show. Then they had that quirky television show where they were on 3 times a day for 15 minutes, which is a really cool show. And I watched them, and they would put out a single, and they had a string of like 25 top 10 singles.
Huge.
They were just totally in that business, you know, and they'd put out a single and we'd get a pack of 100 postcards all written in different handwriting by Les Paul and Mary Ford, you know, backwards, forwards, fancy, neat, whatever, requesting their songs at the radio station in Milwaukee. So by the time they had been in town, he'd become my godfather and left. I knew what multi-track recording was. I knew what an electric guitar was. I knew you had to promote singles. And I knew he was the funniest, coolest guy I'd ever saw. So I was on my way.
Wow. So he, at that time, that they hadn't, they he must have, what, he had a prototype for the electric guitar? What was he playing? Because,
you know, he was playing this big kind of blonde guitar. I think it was the log, the one that was like.
Right. The original log, the one that Gibson turned down originally.
Right. And he had, you know, I didn't know he was inventing anything. I just went, boy, electric guitar. This is as cool as it can be. And Les was so great. He was such a great guitar player. He was so funny. Another hotshot guitar player would come in to see him and he'd immediately pull out a handkerchief and put it over his left hand and continue to play, you know, so they couldn't steal his licks. He was just like, he's always pulling that kind of stuff, you know? So I was in love with him and he was the greatest. And then we moved to Texas and I followed him. You know?
Did you learn some guitar? Did he teach you some tricks?
He taught me my first 3 chords and, they were so easy. I could teach anybody to play those 3 chords. It's very, very easy. And he just made it all seem like fun. He was really great.
That's great.
And then we moved to Texas and all of a sudden I'm in this world where there's just music everywhere. My pop's recording Sister Rosetta Thorpe down at the Baptist Church. And
you saw her?
T-Bone Walker is, yeah. And T-Bone Walker is like a family friend who comes by and plays at the house. And I've got all these recordings of him. And that's where I learned my stuff.
Right. Steve, isn't it true? I mean, you know, it's all T-Bone Walker. All the guitar licks are T-Bone Walker. Like it all goes back to him.
It's crazy. And I'm 9 years old and sitting right next to him going, "Hey, T-Bone, how do you do this? How do you do that?" He showed me how to play the guitar behind my head and do the splits when I was nine.
Yeah.
And he was the nicest guy. He was a real gentleman and he was phenomenal. And I have recordings done at our house that are just unbelievable that we found in the vault.
why don't you put them out on your label?
Well, we are, and we're working with T-Bone's daughter right now. And,
that's great. So
all that's coming out. You know, there's all that kind of stuff that goes on at the vault, at the warehouse, you know, and lots of projects coming up. And we've got a great team at Universal who's like on our side and wants to do all this stuff. They're the ones who kept going, "Yeah, let's put out this concert, this live concert. This is great." When I was going, "I don't know, it looks so bad. Why make a video, you know, blah, blah, blah."
People like it. It'll bring people back. But So in Texas, that's where you kind of start learning how to play, and you're spending. Now, where does your guitar take you? I mean, do you commit to it then, or do you go to college? Do you start a band in Texas? What happens?
Well, I loved playing guitar, so I played guitar all the time. And when I was in the seventh grade, I met a kid who had been taking drum lessons since he was 5 years old, and he could play like Gene Krupa. He was an absolute phenomenal drummer. And another kid who was in love with Ricky Nelson, looked like Ricky Nelson and played guitar. And I said, "We should put a band together." So we did. And we mimeographed letters. It's 1956 in Dallas. I'm 12 years old in the seventh grade. And I mimeographed a letter and sent it out to every fraternity and sorority. I had an older brother, 3 years older, and a cousin who was older than me. So I was seeing what was going on in college, and they had parties, and everybody had live music in Texas back then. Anyway, every party you went to, there was a band.
Did you know the Winter Brothers?
I never met them until later, you know, and I was before those guys. I was like 10 years before those guys. I had the number one band in Dallas, and nobody knew how old we were. We were booked. We booked that first band for the whole year in 3 weeks. It was booked for the whole year. Boz was in that band. Boz Skaggs was in that band.
Oh, you knew him that early on?
Yeah. And so we all went to the same school, and it was a really good band. We were very entertaining, and we were really good, and we knew what we were doing. And that's when I started playing harmonica, because we started off doing instrumentals like Ricky Nelson would do on the Ozzy and Harriet show at the end of the dance. Ricky would come up and do a couple of numbers. That's how we started work. And we've been working every Friday and Saturday night since 1956.
You know? And really?
And so, I started playing, and I mean, that was a really, really good band. And in Texas, you had to play blues. They wanted to hear, you know, Jimmy Reed and Bill Doggett and Bobby Blue Bland and Little Walter and Muddy Waters. They didn't want to hear Fabian and Annette and the Dick Clark stuff. You know,
so you're playing honky tonk. Junk.
Absolutely. Parts one and two. Note for note. You know, I love that song. It's one of my very favorite songs. In fact, I've been playing honky tonk the whole pandemic. I've been practicing it and playing it. I love that stuff. That's what I love. Yeah, it is. It's great. Well, I'm glad to hear you like that. That's good.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, it was one of the first guitar runs I ever heard and I ever wanted to play, because I play a bit. But
You need to meet Danny Caron then, because Danny's like was Charles Brown's musical director, and he's Mr. Honky Tonk on the guitar.
Oh, yeah? Really? Oh, he's the guy?
He's the guy. You should talk to him next.
Well, it's so interesting, you know, to me that, well, let's just go further along. So you got Boz playing with you, and then you guys move back up to Chicago, or how does it, you know?
Well, at that time, we were all just white middle-class kids. And we were going to go to college and we were going to earn a living and we were going to learn how to take care of ourselves. You know, that was the plan. So I went to the University of Wisconsin. Boz was a year behind me. When I got to the University of Wisconsin, 1961, there were no rock and roll bands there. There were no live rock and roll bands in the local scene. Anyway, so we're in college and I start this band. I went to Denmark, went to school over there for a semester and lived over there for a year and came back and kind of went, you know, I really am a musician. This up until that point, I was still pretending I was going to teach creative writing and, you know, be a writer.
Yeah.
And a journalist and yeah, blah, blah, blah. You know, I had all this other stuff I was going to do, but the whole time I was playing guitar. And I went to Chicago. I saw Butterfield's band and I just went.
With Bloomfield?
No, it was pre-Bloomfield.
Mm.
And I think it was his best band. The best band was pre-Bloomfield because it didn't have all the lead guitar theatrics and it was more like Little Walter's band.
Right,
it
yeah, yeah.
Classically put together. It was Elvin and Jerome Arnold and Sammy Lay and Paul Butterfield. And they were great. And they just, an article was written about him in Time magazine, Blue Eyed Soul, I think it was called or something like that. And he got a record deal. And I went to see him. And I was so cocky when I saw him. I went, really? I've been doing this since I was, you know, 12 years old. Hell, I could get a record contract.
Yeah.
Boing. Light bulb goes off. I go back, you know, to my English class. I talk to my, my counselor, my advisor, and he's telling me that I'm 6 credits short of graduating this year and they're not going to accept my credits from the University of Copenhagen. And I went, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm going to Chicago. I had this little meeting, my mom and dad came to see me and my mom said to me, she said, Stevie, what are you going to do? And I gave the answer every parent wants to hear. I want to go to Chicago and play blues.
Yeah.
If my old man had a 2x4, he would have hit me with it. And my mother opened her purse, pulled out $100 bill and said, you're young. You don't have any responsibilities. Here's $100. You should go right away. See That's if you can sweet. Make it.
Yeah.
And I went, okay.
Yeah.
And then I entered the world of the Chicago Mafia and a world of crime and drugs and blues. And, you know, I loved it. I mean, Chicago was really gritty and it was all happening. I got there.
But you seem like the one thing I noticed, Steve, is like, you know, when I'm listening to all your music is like, you seem like a pretty well-adjusted guy. Like, I mean, Like even in the old records, you know, 68, 69, there's something sort of controlled and sort of together about you. I don't listen to your stuff and wonder if you're going to live through the song. You know what I mean?
That's great. Can I use that quote?
Sure.
That's the best thing I've heard in a long time. It's like, well, yeah, because, you know, like, I mean, come on, man, you know. I'm hanging out with Les Paul and then I see kids who want to have a rock band.
Yeah.
They didn't even know how to make a record, you know,
sure,
they didn't
sure.
know how to do anything. So I was learning really fast and I got to Chicago and it really was, what was great was that's where I became a man, an adult. I stopped being a kid playing, you know, Little Richard tunes at a fraternity party or something.
What was the moment? Like what made the shift? Just the grit of the place?
It was 2 o'clock in the morning watching Otis Spann and Muddy Waters play in a club that held 75 people and being able to see them night after night and Howlin' Wolf and, Junior Wells and Buddy Guy and James Cotton and I became really good friends. And
he's on on the Joker, right? James Cotton. So were you playing with those guys or just watching them?
No, I was playing with them and
how did that work? Would they just be like, hey, I got a kid here who wants to come up and.
No, that doesn't work like that. The way it worked was I formed a band with Barry Goldberg.
Yeah.
And we were in competition, if you can believe this, with Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Junior Wells and Buddy Guy for the gigs that were in the near north side and the south side of Chicago. And there were like 3 or 4 nightclubs that had blues.
Yeah.
And the hootenanny people had become blues people, you know, and they were all going to the blues clubs. So there was a pretty hot scene going on. And I came into town and was like, showing up, and I got Wednesday night and Thursday night and Tuesday night and then Monday night and then Saturday night. And so they knew who I was. And,
yeah.
And so in Chicago, the way it worked is you played from 9 at night till 4 in the morning. That's what a normal nightclub set in Chicago was.
Come on. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it is crazy, but it's a mafia town. That's the way it was. That's when a lot of business was done.
But so you can't repeat songs for an 8-hour shift.
Exactly. You got to do an 8-hour shift and you're 45 on and 15 minutes off. And I loved it. We all loved it. And we were working all the time. And so if we weren't working, we were sitting in that same club watching Muddy or Howlin' Wolf. And I became really good friends with Howlin' Wolf. Muddy Waters and his band were just absolute masters. And when you would, when you're listening to Muddy Waters on Wednesday night, you know, in February in Chicago, and there's nobody there, man, that was some music, So that was a big growing up time.
So they were just tight and in the pocket. You just,
like, they were just real, just so adult. Like, there's a whole bunch of things I took away from Chicago. Like, oh, Little Walter arranged everything. All of this stuff was done, was Little Walter's thinking. Little Walter was the John Coltrane, Miles Davis of the blues scene. He was a fucking genius.
Yeah.
And he was my number one artist that I loved the most. And
is that where you learned how to play that harp?
Yeah.
Listening to Little Walter?
No, I learned to play harp listening to Jimmy Reed. I'd been playing harp before. I'd been playing harp with a microphone through a basement, a Fender basement amp, when, in 1957. So I that was before I had really, really heard of Little Walter. So when I got into Little Walter, I was stunned. Little Walter just became my Bible of music.
So there you are in Chicago. So what shifts, man? How do you decide? I mean, what do you do next? How do you evolve out of the blues? What's the first step?
Was our mafia manager, of course. Uh-huh. We're in Chicago.
Yeah.
So Barry's got a mafia manager, and all of a sudden we're going to make a record for Mercury Records. So they sign us up, and they put us in the studio, and they give us 3 hours on one afternoon and a couple hours the next morning to make our album.
We
got this thing, and Barry had written, Barry was a great writer and a great pop tune music guy. And he had written a bunch of pop tunes. So that's what the manager wanted.
What happened to that guy?
Barry?
Yeah.
Well, he's in LA. He's done a lot of things with the Four Tops, and he's, an established session guy and master of keyboards in LA, and has been for years and years and years. He was real tight with Bloomfield. They were real good buddies. So we make this record, and all of a sudden we're on the Kenny G show in Cleveland. And then we go to New York. This is like right from playing in a nightclub in Chicago. We go to New York and do Hullabaloo with the Supremes and the Four Tops.
Which record?
It was, I don't even remember what the name of the album was, the Goldberg Miller Blues Band. We did, a bunch of Jimmy Reed tunes and some of Barry's tunes. And he had written a song called The Mother Song. And that's the one they were promoting.
Huh.
You guys have it?
I don't know. Does that even exist anymore?
I don't think so.
The record?
Yeah, I don't think it's, you can buy it now. But so we went, we go to New York. And then we play Hullabaloo, and we're on national television.
With the Supremes?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And the Four Tops. And then we get a job in this mafia nightclub in Manhattan called the Phone Booth.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell you the difference between the Chicago mafia and the New York mafia. The Chicago mafia, they all wear kind of shiny suits and chew gum and have sunglasses on. And in New York, everybody looks like Cesar Romero in a tux.
Yeah.
And it was crazy, man. And we played this joint for 6 weeks. The Young Rascals had been there. Oh. Bob Dylan was coming in and out, trying to steal Barry from the band for his band. The Lovin' Spoonful were there. You know, all these people were around all the time. And yeah, Dylan was around and was really jive. I didn't like Dylan at all. He was just like real high. And Bobby Newirth was with me and his polka dot shirt on. He kept calling Barry Jerry, you know, he'd say, "Where's Jerry?" And I was just going, "Get out of here," you know. But yeah, that was New York. And we kind of got things going, but the record wasn't going to happen. Nothing was going on. So we go back to Chicago. And the whole scene had just dissipated and was gone.
Really?
It was just gone.
What happened?
Everybody went to California.
Oh.
And all of a sudden, you know, like College got into blues and Muddy started, his record started moving again. Their careers, when I was in Chicago, their careers were over. They had had all their big hits and they were done and they were living back in Chicago and were working on the, you know, the folk music club, the blues club, wherever they could.
Yeah, Muddy was like painting the Chess studio. Like he was like, they were doing odd jobs here and there. And I guess what was it? The English guy started recording their music and turned everyone on again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. So we go out to California, the psychedelic scene's just starting, it's all happening, and then Butterfield's out there first, yeah, and then I went there and I lived there, and we're telling Bill Graham, man, you got to get the James Cotton Band, you got to get Howling Wolf, you got to get Muddy Waters, you need Junior Wells and Buddy Guy, and Graham had, you know, he was open 7 nights a week, he needed bands, and he had the scene going, yeah. And we just started bringing the Chicago guys in. Then they started playing colleges. And, you know, the minute you can make $3,000 a night playing a college instead of $500 a week working for a mafia guy in Chicago,
everything
you're gone,
changes.
Man.
Yeah.
And the scene, I mean, it literally was just whoosh, gone.
But you were, but everyone was hanging out in the Bay Area.
Everybody went to the Bay Area and me included. You know, I got the hell out of there too.
So how does that first record with the Steve Miller Band, how does Children of the Future happen?
Well, we got to San Francisco and basically all the bands there were really amateur bands. I mean, the Grateful Dead was really an amateur band. The Jefferson Starship was a little better.
What about Moby Grape?
Moby Grape came in and Jerry Miller and those guys, we were part of that scene. The guys who opened up the scene were like folk music guys who went, hey, let's be rock stars. Let's get rock boots. Let's grow our hair long. Let's get electric guitars. Let's have a rock band.
Yeah.
And they started all that stuff. And oh, by the way, everybody take acid. So everybody did. And it became a social phenomena. And then they needed to feed it with music. And I showed up going, hi, I'm a band leader. You need some help? And put a band together and just started playing right away. And we played at the Fillmore Auditorium more than anybody. We did 120 different gigs there. And I
really?
Mean, like not one-nighters. I mean, different events there, so it might be four nights.
You don't strike me as a drug guy. Were you doing the acid?
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. You know, I did the acid in Madison.
Yeah,
I did the real acid, not the crap acid on the West Coast. I did the lysergic 25 LSD 25 from Switzerland with Sidrin.
Yeah. Yeah.
We were way ahead of that stuff.
Do you like
we had already solved the problems of the world and didn't need to take acid ever again. We went on trips that were like, you know, poetry and music and jazz.
Yeah,
We didn't like, you know, drop acid and go down and watch pro wrestling.
Right, right. Yeah, man.
You know, when I got to San Francisco, I felt like I was way ahead of
you're ready
what
to work
was going on there. And I put my band together and we started playing, and it was like, you know, I guess it was like Paris was in the 20s or something. Everything was there and it was really great for a few years before it got overwhelmed with the "If you're going to San Francisco, put some flowers in your
sure,
hair" song,
sure.
Which brought 400,000 people to the streets and turned it into a, you know, just a horrible scene. But that was a great time. So what happened was all the record companies wanted to sign anybody and everybody who was in San Francisco. And there were 14 record companies that came running into San Francisco and wanted to sign me. So yeah. I had a feeding frenzy going on. And I had a friend who was a prosecuting attorney who didn't really care about the music business. And I went to him and I said, I need you to represent me. These guys are crooks, they're gangsters. And here's what I want. And I told him I wanted complete artistic control. I wanted enough money to make 5 albums with a no-cut contract. And blah, 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 blah. And everybody laughed at me. But because there was this feeding frenzy going on, we kept playing everybody off against each other. And I got the contract. And it's the same contract I work on today. I couldn't get that contract today if I tried, you know.
So it was with Capitol Records for 5 records?
Yeah. Yeah, which they then changed to 7 records and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
It's so interesting to listen to the old stuff now. When was the last time? Do you ever listen to it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you know, on Sailor, you've got some straight up psychedelic stuff and I can hear the time in some of the songs and I can hear you kind of finding your way through that. But then, you know, like Living in the USA is sort of the template for the Steve Miller sound and songs that become your biggest hits almost a decade later. It's kind of interesting, right? And
yeah.
And it strikes me that Living in the USA, I mean, were you like, I don't know why it hit me, because I was trying to figure out what defines your sound, but there's something Mitch Ryder about it. Were you a Mitch Ryder guy?
Yeah, I love Mitch Ryder. And I love, you know, blues bands. I liked a tough band. Yeah. I liked a band that kicked ass and was, that was good. And, you know, when I was in Madison, like I was a freedom rider and I was a member of SNCC and I got into all the politics and, you know, I went and demonstrated and got on the bus and rode off to the South. So I had all this political kind of feeling and, you know, I wanted my songs to have that. You know, I didn't want to just all be candy ass pop music, you know.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, but coming from a blues world, and as I was growing up, I began to realize that, yeah, man, I was really lucky. I grew up in Texas, and Jesus, Les Paul was, boy, I did know T-Bone Walker. I started really giving me a perspective of what I was doing, and so I was serious about writing and, you know, trying to speak to social issues. And I think Living in the USA was really basically written for the 1968 Democratic Convention, which it was obvious it was going to turn into what it was going to be.
Yeah. But what's interesting is, like, you know, on top of all that is that there, you know, your production is meticulous and your bands are fucking tight. So, you know, like the sound that you get that makes, you know, because you can always, I can recognize a Steve Miller song no matter what, just because of your voice, but there's a groove to it and there's a compression to it. There's a tightness to it. There's, you know, you're not wasting any time really. You know, I don't know. There's just something about the groove that's very specific to you. And I think it's just because your bands are so goddamn tight.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I work really hard at that. And watching Les make records, you know, Les's records are great.
Yeah.
And making records is one thing, and live performance is another thing. And when you go into the studio, everything changes, and you have to learn a whole new way to work, and you're creating kind of a fantasy. You know, you go in, everything's dry and dead and blah, 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 and engineers with glasses and you're supposed to like create something that's really great, when if that's what you wanted to do, you just go down to the club and play and record it there. And so I like the idea of producing records. And when I was a kid, I was listening to the Modern Jazz Quartet. I thought they were fantastic. I was listening to lots and lots of jazz. I loved Ray Charles. I loved the early Stax records.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I liked it. Like my first record that I made, when I made it with Glenn Johns, like we argued all the time because Glenn Johns was like an English kind of pop engineer and he had lots of echo on everything. And I was going, fuck it, Glenn, goddamn, you know, dry it up, tighten it up, make it sound this way, that way, you know. So we were fighting all the time. So for you to recognize that in the records is really important, because we took it really seriously.
Well, no, but that's what defines, you know, the sort of sound, because it's all, you know, there's an edge to it, but there's not, you know, a menace or a rawness or you know, it's all very, even, you know, when you're rocking the hardest, it's pretty soothing stuff somehow. And I think that's because of the production.
Yeah. I always want my stuff to be musical.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people that I really appreciate are the musicians where you can hear what they're playing rather than the 13th floor elevators or whoever, you know, that rather than a bunch of kids with their amps turned up to 10, just, you know, wah, and right, screaming and yelling.
Right, right.
I'm much more impressed by musicality.
Sure, man. And you had a good rhythm section, man. Those first always, few records.
Thanks, man. Yeah. I mean, you know, I try and find the best guys I can work with who will put up with me, you know,
yeah.
that we can get together and create good work.
And I love those tunes. I love Lucky Man, you know, and then, yeah. I guess Gangster of Love is on that character is on Sailor. That was the first time he's mentioned, right?
Yeah.
And then Johnny
Guitar Watson, you know, I mean, uh-huh. he was the original, the real Gangster of Love.
But then like it's so funny, man. If I listen to Brave New World, you know, what's that? The third record. And, you know, I listen to like My Dark Hour and I'm like, ah, there's the lick. Like, you know, you took that lick from that and you processed, that's Fly Like an Eagle.
Well, I was working on, My Dark Hour was like a real fluke. I was in London. It was 1969. The Beatles were finishing up a project and Glenn said, come on, let's go to a Beatles session. I was going, a Beatles session? Are you kidding me? So we went, I met McCartney. They were supposed to do a session the next day. Lennon and Ringo didn't show up. George came over. So there was Paul, me, and George. We went into the studio and just started playing around guitar. George got bored and left. McCartney jumped on the drums. And I said, let me show you this lick. I got this thing I'm working on, man. And so I started playing, and he started playing the drums, and boom, we did My Dark Hour. And 6 hours, we just made it up and wrote it and finished it. And then
you and McCartney.
That lick was something that I had always been working on, and it started playing it all the time, you know, from then till 1969 to 1976, man. I was like growing that lick and working with it until I finally got it right, you know.
Baby do do,
yeah you are a guitar player, that's I could see, that's good.
Well, yeah, it just sort of like it pops out. I'm like, oh man, that lick had to germinate. You know, it's like, yeah, you didn't want to let that lick go. Other people would have been like, because it's like, it's a specific riff. But, you know, and you put it on My Dark Hour, but you weren't going to let it. It meant more to you than that. That's funny. Yeah.
And I learned that lesson really from McCartney, because the little time I spent with him during those few days we were together, you know, I was going, so, you know, tell me, how does it work and everything? But, you know, do you have any regrets or anything? And he said, yeah. He said, I wish I had taken more time with these songs. He said, we wrote all those songs so fast. He said, it was like we were going to work. We got there at 10 in the morning. We left at 3:30 in the afternoon and we'd cut three songs, you know,
yeah,
and then we'd write two more the next night. And he said, I wish I had taken more time with those songs. And I did that with Fly Like an Eagle, and I did that with Abracadabra.
Mm.
Of what he told me. I just kind of went, you know, like there's this moment where you're like putting your next album together and it's 11:59 and 30 seconds and you're going to say, okay, that's it. And both times I kind of went, no, wait, take that song off. It's not ready yet. And they went, what are you talking about? You know, because we just spent like, you know, 15 days mixing it and working on it. And
yeah.
$12,000 recording it and flying people in or whatever. And it's, what are you talking about? It's just not ready. Take it off, you know? And both times it paid off very well. Glad I followed that advice.
Well, so the first real hit you had was Living in the USA?
Well, living in the USA it's kind of funny. It took off and then it disappeared. And then a couple of years later, it sold 100,000 copies in like 4 days in Philadelphia around the 4th of July. This was still in the days when DJs would go, "Hey, here's a little, let's spin a little Steve Miller living in the USA." So it went up and went down, but it never became a real hit. So I never had a real bona fide, "You can't fuck with me, take it away from me, or do anything" kind of hit until the Joker.
And right.
The Joker was like what we call when things go viral now. It really wasn't my record company promoting me or working me. That song just came out and just went, wah.
People locked in. It's so funny leading up to that, though. I do have to compliment you on, I think your version of, and I've heard several versions of Mother with Children from Your Saving Grace, which, and I love that album. And that's that, and your cover, that's great.
You know, we just, a couple of years ago, man, we were in the studio just fooling around, and we did a new version of it that we're not releasing just because there's no reason to release it. That's really great. I've always loved that song. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. I love it. And then, so the Joker, I mean, I remember that. I didn't realize it was 73. So, yeah, because that song is like, it's just part of all of our brains. And you know what I mean? I mean, that song is just there, but I thought it was a little later. So that lit you up, huh?
Yeah, that I was at the end of my career. Capitol Records was not very interested in me. They had just spent $3 million in signing a new English group called Flash.
Oh, those guys, they're amazing.
And the last conversation I had with the guys at Capitol Records, the Joker was the first album I produced myself. I kicked Sidran out of the studio. I kicked everybody out of the studio and just said, "All right, you know, there's no money. This is it. I got to make this record. And this is my last record probably."
It was on Capitol?
And so I told the guys at Capitol, some kid at the record company said, "Hey, you know, I really like that Joker song, you know?" And I said to him, "Listen, man, I don't care about singles anymore." I said, "Here's a list. These are the 60 cities I'm going to starting tomorrow night in Florida. And I want you to just have my albums in those cities. Can you do that? Can you just do that much? You know, can you actually have product available?"
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, I hated those guys. I was so mad at them because they were, you know,
they didn't give a shit anymore.
They didn't pay. They didn't give a shit. They didn't know how to do anything. They were just high on cocaine and running around and bumping their heads into the wall and going to parties and shit and junk and stuff, you know? So I was seriously working, you know, and I didn't like that. So took off and went and did the 60 cities and got back to San Francisco, and the Joker was being played twice an hour, 24 hours a day, on every radio station in the United States that played music. And when I was going to do my last gig in Oakland at the Fox Theater, right? Yeah. We were still playing 2,000 seat rooms. I went on the way over, I was listening to the radio, and the Joker was on 4 of the 5 channels in the Bay Area. And I was pissed off because it wasn't on the 5th one, you know, at the same time. Yeah. You know, it was like crazy. Then I came down to L.A. and, you know, I was the greatest guy in the world, and whatever I wanted to do was just great and blah, 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 blah.
How much did that thing sell, that song?
It, you know, I don't know. It's so mixed up in the greatest hits and all these other things. It sold millions and millions and millions and millions of copies.
Your
airplay is nuts.
You're still making money on that song right now. As we're talking, you're making a few.
As we're speaking, the Joker's being played somewhere in Fiji. There's a Fijian band playing the Joker, and then they're going to do Space Cowboy.
Well, you get those satellite residuals. You get those sound exchange checks. Those things still process through.
They do, but, you know, it's so different. I mean, the 90s were the last of that, you know,
sure,
where
the ASCAP money.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only money we really make now is when we tour. And, you know, that's the same for everybody, unless you're just the world's biggest superstar and blah, 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 blah. And so putting out records is really a completely different kind of game. It used to be a really fun game, you know, trying to make hits and trying to get on top of the charts and beat the Beatles or whoever it was, you know, there's all that stuff going on, you know, for producers of records. And that's what I was. I was producing myself and working on that side of the game too, which I really loved.
What was the big change you made when you took over? I mean, what was the difference in your approach to production with the Joker that changed the sort of sound into what became your vision? Was it just putting the vocals up front more?
You know, it was the way it was mixed.
Yeah.
It was the way the recording sessions were done. Before making every album was always such a big deal, and it cost so much money, and you had so many people involved in it, and it was like you had a lot of people telling you what to do, and I was always arguing with people all the time. Ben and I used to argue all the time about the records we worked on, and Glenn Johns and I used to just have, you know, knockdown, drag out, 4 o'clock in the morning kind of fights about it. And finally, I got rid of all those people. Like every time I go in to make an album, like the producers, the engineer would be the producer's pal, not my pal.
Yeah.
You know that it was always like that. And I just got rid of them all. And I picked my own engineer. I brought the band in and cut the tracks in 2 days, and then spent, you know, 15 days overdubbing and mixing and editing and cutting and, you know, rewriting a paragraph here and there and, you know, dusting it off, and that was done.
It's interesting because Glenn Johns is like a massive producer.
Oh, yeah. Glenn is, he was like a rock star when we first started working with him. He'd already done the Stones and the Who, and it's kind of funny, you know, like a lot of people love the way he records and makes records, and a lot of people don't. And the Eagles and I both have this same kind of like, nah, we're out of here kind of feeling. I learned a lot from Glenn. He taught me a lot about making records.
Yeah.
I made my first album in England at Olympic Studios. That's where I got Children of the Future. So I started at Capitol and went down there and did my first session. And my second session, and the engineering staff walked out at 2 a.m. They just said, fuck this, and they left. And so I was going to tear up my contract with Capitol, and I called my producer and said, hey, you can have the money back. I'm going to go somewhere else. And he said, no. And part of my that deal I told you about, I had, was that I could produce my own records and I could go anywhere I wanted to record. I didn't have to work at Capitol Records.
Right.
Usually record companies made you rent their studio. You know, you became a client of theirs as well, you know. And so we went to London to Olympic Studios, and Glenn was an engineer. We got him to be our engineer.
Wow.
That's how I started. And we were overdubbing and stuff, and so I kind of went to school in the school of English, making English pop records.
Yeah, that makes sense, man. That makes sense in terms of the sound. So then, like, it took 3 years for you to put together Fly Like an Eagle. Why? Because you were on the road with the Joker or what?
Yeah, I mean, I got back from the Joker, and I had been on the road for 11 years, and I'd been fighting for 11 years, and I went into the studio at Capitol Records. They were just like, more, right in the studio, come back, and I went in, and I remember it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I just sort of strummed my guitar and looked at the guy and said, you know, I got nothing to say, nothing to do, I'm out of here, you know, I'm just exhausted.
Yeah.
So cut everything off and went to San Francisco and had a check for $380,000 in my mailbox and bought a house with the junk mail, man. I was like, you know, it was like that fat. And I opened up and went, and that's when I went, I've got a hit. Shit, this is great. So I bought a house. I bought a 3M 8-track tape recorder and set it up in the living room. And I just moved there and lived there by myself. And
we're at Bay Area?
Sort of, yeah, in Novato.
Yeah.
You know, outside of the city. And found a really cool old house in the woods and set it up and just sat there and got real bored and got real used to that and just not going out and partying and just working.
Yeah.
And started working. And I wrote, I don't know, 25 songs, probably wrote 50 songs throughout half of them and ended up with 25 songs or so. And And called up Gary Malibur, great drummer, got Lonnie Turner, the bass player, and said, we're going to go in and cut the basic tracks just as a trio. I don't want, the less people there are, the more I can control what's going on. We went in and cut all the tracks for Fly Like an Eagle and Book of Dreams and all those hits as a trio.
Both records?
Yeah. Cut them in 11 days, cut everything.
Oh, no
and
shit.
We were doing two tracks a day.
Right.
And we got, and then they all took off, went and did what they did. And then I went back to my house and just thought about my tracks. I had an 8-track tape recorder and I'd cut them 16-track and I mixed it down to a stereo mix. I had a sync tone, so that left me 5 open tracks. So I had a sync tone, a stereo mix of the rhythm tracks, and 5 open tracks, and I just engineered everything myself, and I sang all the parts myself, and I played all the guitar parts myself, and I did it over and over and over and over until I was really happy with what I had, where it was the way I wanted it.
Yeah.
Wiped the tape 100 times, and started again. And it was really, the limitations were great, 5 tracks, And
that's what you did that all? That's what the record is?
Yeah. And then we took it back to the studio, synced it up to the 16 track.
Yeah.
So we now had like 8 tracks of drums and, whatever.
Sure.
And just took my stuff that I recorded in my living room with a Shure level lock and a Electro Voice microphone. And, I was done.
Wow.
And mixed the album in 17 hours. We just sat down and mixed it, and we did stereo mix, we did a quad mix, and we did the singles mixes all in one session.
Quad mix, 1976. Quad mix.
Yeah, baby.
That's amazing, man. I just noticed something. And this is the first time I noticed it. You're playing a left-handed Strat, right-handed on the cover.
Yeah. So reason being, I had, I first saw Jimi Hendrix at the Montreux Festival. The Monterey Festival.
Did you
Monterey
know him?
Pop Festival. Well, yeah, I met him there.
Yeah,
that was so cool. He looked like Eartha Kitt with a guitar.
Uh-huh.
He just walked around the corner, and I went, "Eartha Kitt with a guitar,"
uh-huh.
And and we started
How'd he
talking.
Take that?
He was like very shy and real. I mean, he was a very humble, sweet guy. And we became friends, and he used to let me sit on the stage when he played. So I was probably sitting 4 feet away from him, at the corner of the stage, just out of the range of his monitor where he would be playing.
Yeah.
During all those Winterland shows. And what I noticed was that, he was such a great guitar player, so I was studying how he played. I didn't want to play his exact stuff, but his techniques and stuff. And what he could do was he could pick up a Strat like this, right?
Yeah.
And because it was upside down, the vibrato bar was this way, so he could hold it with his thumb and he could go, and he would do that. That's how he was doing a lot of those.
Just squeezing it. Yeah.
With his hand, like, he wasn't doing this.
Right,
he was
right.
doing this.
Right.
And to do that, you had to have an upside down guitar.
Oh, so it was mostly for the vibrato effect? Isn't the intonation a little weird too, because of the way the pickups are aligned?
Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't. So I went to New York, went to Manny's, and Jimmy had ordered these two left-handed Strats. And which I thought was really odd, and he had just died, they said, "Do you want them?" And I said, "Yeah, I do," because they were left-handed. So I took them. Then I sent them to Nashville, had everything flipped so I could play. And then the hardest part was learning to turn the volume off when you wanted to turn the volume up. Many time I would step out to take a solo and turn my guitar off. And that particular guitar, I still have the white one. The black one got stolen, but the white one I still have, and it's a great, great sounding Stratocaster. And I never changed the pickups. I didn't, move them around or anything, and cut some great records with that. And that's why I did it. I mean, I thought, controls up here and everything. I've since made Strats that have the regular controls, but they're I've made left-handed guitars, but made sure that the controls worked like right.
You mean you had them made for you?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like, what was so like? I'm watching that 77 thing, the thing that you're, you know, you're releasing. It's like, what's with all those the Ibanezes?
Well, it's, you know, it's kind of cool. What
you guys are playing matching Ibanez, and the other dude has a fucking Music Man. I mean, it's like a whole onslaught of unhip instruments.
Right, and what was going on?
Yeah.
Those were those guitars we had are actually great. Okay. They sound great. Yeah. So,
no, I'm not saying they didn't sound good, but like now, you know, everybody.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
But here was the thing: like Fender told me to go fuck myself. Gibson wouldn't pick up the phone. I was trying to work with guitar makers and stuff, yeah. and the only company that was interested was Ibanez. There was a guy named Jeff Hasselberger, who's a great, great guitar guy. And he came to me, he said, "We'll make you anything you want, man. What do you want?" And I started going, "Well, I want one of these. I want one of those. I want one of those. Yeah, that's great. Like, can I get one with the Tree of Life?" And, you know,
yeah.
Bob Weir did it. Bob always got the fancy guitars. Like when I see Bob play his Ibanezes, it's got more inlay than 10 guitars. You know, Bobby went. So Bobby and I were working with Hasselberger and developing these guitars, and they'd make us any kind of pickups we wanted. They make, you know, I had them, they were making me 8-string basses and all sorts of stuff. And they were all great instruments.
Sure,
and,
man.
And, they were the only people that even, you know, had any interest in me as an artist at all.
Really? Well, that's interesting. The Ibanez deal, and you guys, and Bob Weir too. Bob Weir, like, boy, he's a troubadour. You guys buddies?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I spent a lot of time with Bob. What I like best, I've put backup bands behind Bob, you know, for private gigs and parties and stuff like that. And I love to do that. And I get him there and get him singing. And, he's a great singer, you know, and I've put some really great bands together.
How is that your job?
Stuff. Well, we kind of, hang out in the, you know, the Bay Area, and there's like it's like at parties. Like,
oh,
we're having a party, man. Put a band together this. And you guys come over, and you know, the party's for you and us and everybody. It's
picking
it's
up a little like that tech money, those $250,000 garden gigs.
No, but those gigs are nuts.
Yeah.
You know, I did one of those gigs with let me think. Billy Gibbons.
Oh yeah.
Christine McVie, Mick Fleetwood, and then like all the best LA backup players.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a great fucking gig. It was for some guys in Texas, of course.
Uh-huh. Man, yeah. Fleetwood can fucking swing, huh?
Yeah, he's great. He and I've been pals from the Fillmore days, and I loved that the Fleetwood Mac when they first showed up.
Did you know Peter?
They were the first. I knew Peter. I played with Peter. Most of the time that I spent with him was later, and it was really difficult.
Because he was out there?
He was out there in a kind of way that made you want to say, quit fucking around and play it.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on, God damn it.
What do you think it
We're
was?
We're not going to put up with that bullshit. He would just drive people crazy. I don't know what it was. There was just something about him. He's such a great guitar player. Oh. You know, and it was
I think he was hard on himself.
Yeah, and I think he had problems. I mean, the last time I played with him, he was playing what was that? Are your eggs done?
No, it's a computer, one of them. I got it. It was someone texted me. Go ahead.
John Mayall.
And my eggs are done, thanks.
Yeah, right. John Mayall was playing in the Fillmore.
Yeah.
And Peter Green was playing at the Fillmore with his own band. And Mayall invited me over to come over and play. And, you know, it was just a great, this was like, you know, 97 or 8 or something, maybe later.
So it's fat old Peter Green.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, right. And it was, you know, really a great gig, and Peter was there, and Peter wanted to come and play with us. And we were trying to talk him into playing with us. So he shows up with a band of guys who, like, you know, they all look like 80s rock stars, old middle-aged 80s rock stars with dyed black hair and, you know, guitars that look like axes. and they come out and play like 45 minutes of just absolute bullshit. And then Peter Green came out and played like two songs with them, didn't play any of his good shit, and then left the stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, sooner or later, somebody has to behind the stage say, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know, and nobody would do that. You know, everybody was afraid to do that. I didn't have time to screw around with whatever happened to him. I don't know what it was. And I wasn't around him that much. I just know that I love his records.
Man, no one can move through between that major and minor like him, man. It's like,
no, man, wow. He's the best. He's just really a wonderful one-off great guitarist.
Yeah.
Soul that's huge, you know, and
just broke it. Something broke inside him.
There are a lot of fragile people trying to do this, you know?
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying about you. You know, you never struck me like, you know, like you were going to die mid-song. And you always like, I don't know, man, there's a buoyancy to the whole trip. And that Fly Like an Eagle record, that took care of you for life, huh?
Well, it established me and gave me the success I needed to be able to go and grow for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And yet, you know, you just
the
kept
hardest
going.
Thing is to follow up a big hit with a big hit and then follow up that second big hit with a third big hit and then a fourth big hit and then a fifth big hit.
There are three big hits on that record.
Yeah. I don't know what they are. Rockin' Me, Take the Money and Run, Fly Like an Eagle.
Right. That's it. Yeah.
Wild Mountain Honey. And I mean, a lot of them have turned out to be hits. The thing that was weird about this was at that time we wanted to keep putting out singles off the record, and Capitol Records said it'd really press our credibility with radio. We're not going to put any more singles out.
What? After which
we're selling, you know, 100,000 copies a week. What is wrong with you? I mean, it was crazy, the arguments we had with them.
I don't know why. It's crazy. And then the next one, which you basically wrote all those songs at the same time, Jet Airliner, Swing Town, Jungle Love from...
Well, Paul Pina wrote Jet Airliner. I just rearranged it and, you know, shuffled the lyrics around a little bit, but that was a Paul Pina tune.
Book of Dreams and Fly Like an Eagle were sort of done within the same period of time.
Yeah.
Wild, man. Big records, dude.
Yeah, well, I learned that from the Eagles, too. And I mean, the Eagles, probably from the Eagles as well, but from the Beatles. Because when I met the Beatles, they had 40 songs in the can. I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
They had hit after hit after hit after hit. And what happens when you get ahead of it, instead of like, yeah, we just had the biggest hit of our lives and we're all going to go get high and fucked up for 18 months and then we're going to come back and go to work.
Yeah.
You know, that's the wrong way. They were able to just, their timing was just bullet fast, as fast as they needed to have another one. They had it. And that's what I tried to do with Fly Like an Eagle and Book of Dreams, was they were both in the can before I'd left to go on the road with Fly Like an Eagle.
Oh, it's amazing, man. And then, you know, you knocked out a couple of hits more here and there, but it seems like you just kept making good records.
Yeah, I tried to make good records. I just sort of lost my finger on the pulse of pop music and grew up, you know, got older.
But it's interesting to me is that, like, hearing your blues records, the last couple records, where you're going back to it, you know, doing those Jimmy Vaughn songs, Jimmy Reed songs, stuff like it always like is beautiful to me when guys who have the passion for that stuff, and you realize at some point that like any idiot can play the blues, right? So it's just the nature of the music. It's the great thing about it, and also the horrible thing about it is that a bar band could do a pretty good job, you know, with a blues tune. So
it's dangerous, that bar band level.
It is. Yeah. Oh yeah. But like, what makes a person, you know, have a voice and sound different with that music? And like when the Stones put out that record a couple of years ago, Blue and Lonesome, that was fucking unbelievable to listen to that. That this is that could have been the song list of their first album ever. So now they're coming back to it, what, 50 years later, and it sounds exactly like the Rolling Stones. No, those old blues songs, and you're coming back to these old blues songs, and it's like exactly Steve Miller coming back around to the music you love, to the music that speaks to you the most, and singing it with thoroughly as your own guy and making it your own in a way that you couldn't have done at the beginning.
No, that's right. That's astute. I mean, and that's kind of what happens, you know, like my goal really from the time I was 5 years old and saw Les Paul was to be a musician. Yeah. I didn't want to be a celebrity or a rock star. In fact, I didn't even know what that was when I was a kid, because that didn't, you know, the successful rock and roll people were like Fabian,
right?
You know,
sure. Yeah.
They were like people who made surf movies and, you know,
and Dion's doing blues now, has been doing it for over a decade.
Yeah. Dion's great.
Yeah.
You know, and I always loved Dion. Seeing like Run Around Sue and that stuff. Like I would watch Dion on the Dick Clark TV show,
yeah.
American Bandstand. I'd watch those guys.
Yeah.
I loved doo-wop stuff. I always loved anything with soul that was good. And if it was like total utter pop crap, you know, like how much is that dog in the window?
Right.
You know, I just kind of go, you know,
who cares?
Buzz. Yeah. And so if anybody had soul, I always dug it,
yeah.
You know, and I love the doo-wop records and I loved all the R&B stuff. And I loved Dion and the Belmonts and, you know, a lot of those groups. So, and they were all, you know, the doo-wop stuff was all vocals too. And I'm all about the vocals. I love vocal harmonies. That's when you make what I call pop records, you want to have hooks and vocal harmonies.
Yeah, sure.
You know, we want to sing along with it while we're driving to Arizona. Man.
Yeah, man. So but you like going back to the blues.
Oh, all the time into jazz,
yeah.
jazz and blues. And I'm working at Jazz at Lincoln Center now on developing the blues pedagogy for them.
Really? I like that. That I know that guy over there. I talked to Winton.
Winton's a genius.
He's great, dude.
I love working for Winton. Winton collared me and asked me to come help him do that. And I've been doing that for 6 years. I do a series of shows every December at Jazz at Lincoln Center at Rose Theater. And, you know, I brought Charlie Musselwhite and Jimmy Vaughn in, and then I get to have a Jazz at Lincoln Center horn section and rhythm section. And
oh, it's great.
You know, the players are so great, and I've met so many great players. I've moved to New York. So I moved about 8 years ago.
You're in New York right now?
7 years ago. Yeah.
Where, upstate?
Yeah. I'm out of the city right now. I'm in the Hudson Valley.
Oh, nice, man. Yeah. I know guys up there.
I'm like, you know, avoiding the pandemic. I've been here for 15 months, you know, looking at beautiful rolling hills and stuff. I'd give anything to just get back into some of those dives.
Sure, man.
And I've learned so much. It's been such a great thing for me. And my playing, man, the thing that's doing to my personal playing and my personal musical growth.
That's great, man. You seem really engaged and fucking in it. That's
great.
It's
phenomenal. I mean, I'm really glad I moved to New York and got out. I was living in Idaho and there was nothing to do there except ride bicycles, run, ski, train, stay in, and go buy sports equipment, you know, and there was nothing else there, you know. And
except for everything else. You mean there was no music, man. It wasn't
no music. There's no culture, you know, and the culture there was, it was all bar bands. And so I just, said to Janice, I want to move to New York, and she's a New Yorker. So she said, yeah, let's go. So we moved and it was like jumping off a cliff, man. When I first got here, I'd never really lived in the gritty city. You know, I'd been living out on, you know, with mountains and stuff. And I don't know, the first year I was kind of like afraid to go outside at night, you know, and I don't want to go for a walk in the park. Like it was rough, but you know, you get used to it. Now I'm turning into a New Yorker, you know, it's in the quality of musicianship and people I've met and just the intelligence and the different people. And I got another gig at the Metropolitan Museum in the musical instrument department working on that. And we've done those big guitar shows that you saw, you know, the Play It Loud and the Archtop guitar show and the Martin guitar show and everything. So I got two anchors right in the culture of the city just right away when I showed up in town, just by luck, just walked through the door and they said, hey, why don't you do this? And I went, okay.
Well, I'm happy for you, man. You sound great. And it was an honor talking to you. And I hope people enjoy the little movie and always, I know that they love the music, but it's great to hear you're doing so many things and I take care of yourself, man.
Mark, thanks, man. I love your show. I love what you're doing. And it's an honor to be have a little conversation with you. Thanks for listening and for all the hard prep work you did.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. It was great, man. Take it easy, Steve.
All right. I'll see you around the block, man. Bye-bye.
That was Steve Miller. As I said earlier, Steve Miller Band Live, Breaking Ground, the concert album from August 3rd, 1977, comes out this Friday, May 14th. And that video we talked about, the live concert film featuring the full performance in his red suspenders with his Ibanez guitars, is available to stream on the Coda Collection on Amazon Prime Video. Now I will play guitar like usual. Fonda. Cat angels everywhere.